Welcome to Manager Tools. This week's guidance on case studies and the inaugural Manager Tools interactive case. Part one. Here we go. This podcast answers these questions. What are case studies and how are they used? How can I prepare for a case study? If you go to a top business school in the U.S., there's a good chance that you'll end up being exposed to something called the case study method of instruction. And also, to take that a step further and to highlight an upcoming cast, if you want a top-level consulting job, which is one of the more sought-after jobs coming out of a top business school MBA program, you're likely to face a case study interview. The interviews are different, but they're related, and they're both important. And case studies are very important because you wouldn't want to be the manager in a group of managers and/or executives at a cocktail party who didn't know how to discuss a recent case, say, in the MIT Sloan Management Periodical or in Harvard Business Review, where the cases are routinely talked about. You certainly wouldn't want to go to a management development program, one of which Dan has been involved in, and have an executive present a case, engage in the Socratic method with you, and you not know where to begin. Now, there's a lot to teach in cases, and we won't get to everything in this cast, and we've got a multi-part cast coming at you, but we want to introduce the concept and give you a hint of the kind of things you'll face with our inaugural case study. So as I mentioned, our special guest for this inaugural case study is Dan McGuire, a longtime client and friend of the firm. Dan is a financial services technology executive, experienced leading large, massively large mission-critical technology orgs through transformations. Dan began his career as a developer trainee at Merrill Lynch. And Dan, when was that? How long ago was that?
It was 1985.
1985. Okay, so a while ago. He's had increasing responsibilities over the years, from mainframe systems to mobile platforms. He's put together a broad portfolio of leadership roles, head of development, chief architect, and even chief technology officer and chief operating officer, particularly in the financial world. He actually played a role in some major industry events, including running application development integration following the 2008 mortgage crash with Morgan Stanley and Smith Barney's merger in wealth management. He was, in fact, CTO of Morgan Stanley Bank and ran wealth management technology at Thomson Reuters in New York. He went to SUNY Maritime College and he holds a master's in information management from Stevens Institute of Technology. And some of you may know Dan as the namesake of the McGuire hump of the Horstmann curve. And I think the quote, if I'm not mistaken, Dan, was, "Why do I always feel like I'm on the hump?" We've mentioned Dan a few times over the years in our podcast. One time, in fact, we mentioned him as he was crossing Broadway listening to us, and it surprised him so much to hear his voice, he nearly got hit by a car. So we're glad you made it. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here. Obviously, a long-time listener, and you realize you've trained my management teams at three different firms.
Oh, I love that.
You and Mike, and obviously, I got so much value out of working with you guys. Really happy to be a guest, particularly because of this topic. I think this is an underplayed topic, super important, especially if you get to the executive level. It's just a given. You have to have it. So let's rock.
Good. Okay. So we've got really only two items here. I'm going to start out by outlining what case studies are. Dan and I are going to be as interactive as possible. And then Dan and I are going to introduce the inaugural Manager Tools case study. Although I think the case study will probably be part two once we get through the basics of case studies in part one. And then, folks, we have a special treat for you. We're going to give you the case study, and then we're going to give you a chance to write in. We're going to present the case, and the idea will be for you to listen to the case. Obviously, if you're a licensee, you'll be able to download it and read it and so on. And then we're going to take input in the week between part two coming out and part three coming out, and Dan and I will collaborate over the Monday to Saturday and collect all your input, and then tell people what your input was. You'll be mentioned on air, and then we'll critique your answer. And there's an additional bonus even after that. Okay. So in my mind, this is already a Hall of Fame cast, partially because we have a guest like Dan, but also because it's so unique. And as Dan says, case studies, you simply can't become an executive in corporate America or even the rest of the world and not be exposed to the idea of case studies. I would say that probably, well, most of the major business schools use them, but in addition, probably 80% of the high potential development programs that exist in large organizations all over the country, the really well-managed ones, the ones that are famous for developing people and so on. They have people come in and present case studies all the time, and they lead them through a discussion of what happened and what would you do and why do you want to know that? And what then would you do if I told you your answer to that question was this and so on and so on.
Yeah. And a wide variety of topics too, everything from finance to ethics.
Yes.
In fact, regulators now require firms to go through case studies in ethics with their executive team.
Okay, so what is a case study? At its basis, a case study is a business situation or a scenario presented as a problem to a student with the purpose of teaching management, analytical, organizational, problem solving, and communication skills. I mean, literally the whole gamut. And again, they're an important part of the career path for many, many executives, sometimes in business schools, but as Dan mentions, obviously outside. The concept behind case studies is that business leaders are confronted with problems that are usually complex and beyond the scope of most young professionals' previous experience. The way I always think about it is when you're starting to get case studies, you're starting to have to synthesize the HR, the finance, the operations, the logistics, the analytics, the marketing, the communication of what you're going to do. And if you've come up in marketing, maybe you don't know the operations, the logistics. And in fact, that's why many people tend to go to business school, is to get the synthesis of all that, even though we don't like the word synthesis. And studying previous examples of business and organizational situations helps students not only learn the individual skills that leaders and senior managers and consultants use routinely, but also how to combine them to come up with solutions rather than just applying certain tools that you might have learned at a lower level. So case studies are used to teach and at schools anyway, to evaluate someone at the point in their career when they are, as I mentioned, moving from managerial to executive ranks. As a manager, the problems we face might call on those skills in marketing or software development or logistics or manufacturing or whatever. But as we've said before on the show, one of the delineators of the difference between a managerial role and an executive role, and this is one of many delineators, is none of them by themselves are dispositive, is the difference between managerial and executive role is when decisions and plans require multiple disciplines to be considered. If you're a software development manager, you're worried about software development and quality and meeting the deadline. But if you're the business manager, you worry about the perception of the customer. You worry about packaging. You worry about shipping. You're worried about customer support after the fact and ability to address bugs and all kinds of other stuff. Now, Dan, you mentioned that the feds now require classes in ethics. I think you also mentioned to me that one of the reasons you suggested we consider case studies is because you were exposed to them in one of the development programs you were put in as a high potential person. Do I have that right?
Actually, two of them, yeah.
Okay. Can you remember anything about either one of them?
One of the more recent ones that I had was a case of a manager who's given a set of decisions to make around whether to go with a partner or not. And there's a very small nuance of conflict of interest. And you have to, you know, break it down, understand where the conflicts are, and talk about it as a group, and try to evaluate whether this is going to work with the federal government or not in hindsight.
Yeah. And so the interesting, you mentioned about the group, that's part of what the Socratic method does. And one of the reasons people love case studies is because you go into it with your opinion, but you come out of it not only having to struggle with it in public, if you will, but you get to learn from other people's perspective. And somebody else might have that key bit of information and say, actually, I've dealt with this before. The thing I worry about right now is conflicts of interest. And somebody else in the room might go, oh, I wouldn't have even thought to look at that. And so there, you,
exactly.
So now you know, next time you're faced with a potential partnering situation, you go, okay, I got to have conflict of interest in my checklist. Here's an example that I particularly love. I shared it with Dan and he loved it as well. And this one actually happened at the Stanford Business School a number of years ago. It may still be being taught. You're presented with the historical example of an airline company that is struggling while competing with bigger, richer airlines. The dominant big airline in the small airlines market decides it has enough cash and assets that it can lower its prices significantly. Basically, they have enough money to lose money for a while, long enough so that the small company, who's also will be losing money at the price point they will probably have to match of the dominant carrier, the small company will run out of money before the big company does. There are people who would call this predatory pricing. There are other people who would call it competition. So again, to compete, the small airline will have to lower prices. They're going to lose money. And again, actually, both firms will be losing money where this route competition is taking place. But the dominant airline has other routes, and they're making money elsewhere, and they're going to be able to survive this price war. And the overall lower margins and profits on their entire system, whereas the smaller airline will simply be losing money outright and not have any profits elsewhere to offset it. And so the question simply, and I'm way oversimplifying this, is what should the small airline do? In this particular case at Stanford Business School, the students were given passenger loads and costs of fuel and the differential cost of flying a plane on the small airline or the big airline, how many people were flying on each route and so on, which routes were profitable, how much money they made, so that they could determine whether or not if they lowered their prices from $30 to $20, whereas the break-even point was $25, how long, for instance, could you go losing $5? So the question is, should they lower prices to match or to beat the dominant competitor? And again, how long can they last? And when I was reading the case, I thought, that's the Walmart play, right? Lower prices. Or should the smaller company say, no, 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 we're going to let the big company lower prices. We're not going to lower prices. And we're going to compete on something other than price, on flavor, on quality, on style, whatever. And you might think, if you're a modern listener, you might think, oh, that's the Apple approach. Yeah, you can buy cheaper phones, but you can't buy any better phone, say, than Apple, which is one of the reasons why Apple prices its phones the way it does. Not that I'm familiar with Apple's pricing structure, guys. We're not, okay? Now, Dan, would you agree that most frontline managers and maybe even second-level managers or maybe even some middle managers will struggle with that case?
Not this case, but it was an airline case. Was the first case I had in my CIO seminar course back when I was going for my master's at night in the late 90s. And my first response was, I'm an IT middle manager. Airlines? What do I do with this? I was overwhelmed. But read on, because you'll talk about how these things get broken down.
Yeah, exactly. If you're a senior manager, but if all your experience is in software development, you won't have the experience to determine the viability of pricing decisions or market share effects. But you might be thinking, if you're a software development manager right now, when I get to the point where I'm going to have to make pricing decisions, somebody will have told me how. Folks, you're mistaken. There is not some class you're going to go to where they teach pricing in your company. Now, you might say, well, they should, and I might agree with you, but I can prove to you that there's not, because the pricing decision you're going to make is an important one. There's certainly no question about it, and probably somebody in your company has a pricing expert or they have a pricing model, and they'll help you a little bit with it, but they're not going to teach you. And you already have a model for what companies do when they ask you to take on new, different, completely foreign responsibilities. And that's when you went from being an individual contributor to being a manager. I mean, I'm fairly certain I could count on one hand the number of companies that are considered highly effective managed companies that actually train their managers, but train their managers in a class before you go and be a manager. Now, I can hear my friend Dan West at Apple say, well, Apple has a program where, you know, new managers go through it. Yes, you're made a manager. And then over the course of the next 6 months, you go to a series of seminars while you're managing. That wouldn't help you with the pricing decision because you're not going to get 6 months to make a pricing decision. And look, if you're a software development manager or a manufacturer manager, whatever, if you were interviewing for a new higher level job at a different company, one of the questions they'll have in their mind is, can this person transition from being a silo manager, software development, manufacturing, marketing, engineering, whatever, to making business decisions, which synthesizes everything, versus just decisions in their expertise about projects or about people or about technical issues? It is not the same thing. That, again, that's why many people choose to get MBAs. There's all kinds of other ways to learn that stuff, including, as you know, manager tools. So that decision, and by the way, if you don't know, it's a famous case study. And if you don't know case studies, you wouldn't know that's a famous case study. And it's the story of Southwest Airlines. And I will tell you that part of the reason the case is so fun to read, and the book it's in is called Snapshots from Hell, by a guy I know, Peter Robinson, who is now a fellow at Hoover, I think. And the reason it's so interesting is the Stanford professor who assigned the case, and it turned out that Peter, the author, was the guy who was chosen from the crowd of students to present his solution, which was pilloried as being terrible. But what was especially pungent about it was that Raleigh King, the guy who founded Southwest Airlines with Herb Kelleher, was in the wings and came out and talked about what they did and why they did it, which is a rarity in the case study world to actually hear from the people that were there. And it's just, you could just feel Peter in the book melting down that not only did he do poorly in front of the professor, but now he has to talk about it in front of the founder, the guy who clearly made it through and apparently made some decision that turned out reasonably well because Southwest Airlines is a very successful and still a very successful airline. And this story was from the 1970s, as I recall. Now, look, that said, guys, there are case studies that are much more narrow in their scope. Example, what Dan said about ethics. As a business school student in a marketing class, you might get a case study that's only addressing the narrower issue of what market segment is growing fastest based on some data they give you in charts or graphs or Excel or emails about historical sales, product lines, margins, market share, whatever. You might even get a narrower case, a financial case, that could address the implications of cash management, overseas exchange rate fluctuations, determination of the size of a market offering. And I'd be willing to bet that there's somebody in this audience right now who could handle one of those. There's somebody else who could handle another one. Maybe somebody else could handle the marketing one. But the question is, can everybody handle all of them? And that's what cases are designed to help you learn how to do. There might also be a financial case looking for a recommendation on the size of an IPO for a startup, or how to reduce the burn rate of a venture capital funded startup. Or perhaps the choice of how to fund a startup's growth, whether with debt or equity. And those might be a financial decision, and it might also be a retention decision for the founders. And how well are the founders doing their job as they transition from an idea person to the young lady who ends up being CEO? So those situations are somewhat more technical or numerical cases. Obviously, they have other implications. But don't get the impression that all cases are global in nature that require you to make business-changing decisions at the highest level of the company. Sometimes cases are very narrowly drawn to teach you an analytical approach, to teach you a framework for thinking about particular problems. I.e., now I think everybody here should know that if you're faced with a situation where you're thinking about taking on a partner, if the federal government is involved, you know, you need to look for conflicts of interest. Look, because case studies, guys, address a broad array of potential scenarios, there is no approved solution. There's no single answer that you're driving for. It's not just math where you're going to be right or wrong. In fact, here's what's hard for people, particularly when they get them in school. As a general rule, you don't have to correctly solve the case study. In other words, come up with a solution that the people who are running the company did to be thought to have done well on that particular situation. Case studies are usually drawn from historical examples. You could create one that's not, and then build some verbiage around it to make it feel like a case in order to teach a tool, for instance. But typically, they're drawn from historical examples. And a student or an interviewee or whomever needn't come up with the solution that the company did, okay? And it goes further. Even if a student or a manager in a high-potential program came to the same conclusion as the one that was come to in the historical example, your success with the problem may be considered less good than somebody who got the wrong answer, but had the right approach, the right complete analysis, and applied the right tools, even if maybe your math was wrong or some of your assumptions were wrong.
So true.
Yeah. And I really like that. In fact, this is going to sound really geeky, but when I was in high school, my calculus professor was really smart, but kind of lazy. And what he would do is he'd give us a single sheet page calculus test. And it was a problem. It was maybe 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 problems on a single sheet of paper. And then a place to write your answer over on the right, kind of like A, B, C, D, or E. And it was multiple choice. You just got to write your answer. And of course, as I think I've told you before, that the simple assumption in situations like this is to use my brother Walt's rule. The answer to most calculus questions is either 0, plus or minus 1, or plus or minus infinity. It's never 2.75, right? But what was interesting about that was he didn't care whether you had the work all right and then you just simply wrote negative 1 when you should have written 1. And so it basically became a true-false test. Either you were true, you got it right, or you got it wrong, which, if you don't know, folks, is not the way to teach calculus. Then actually, he ended up changing because it was just not, you couldn't tell. I mean, it wasn't a diagnostic tool at all, and he didn't assign homework. And so he couldn't tell whether somebody got all of them wrong, but really understood calculus and just struggled with algebra, or whether somebody guessed and got them all right, but really didn't know what the heck he was doing.
One thing I found in my master's program was I had a professor whose baseline grade, no matter how you did on the case, his baseline grade was going to be about 70. But if you went away from his framework, didn't do the breakdown, didn't do the analysis, no matter how well you did on the case, you got a 0.
Yeah. So in other words, you could nail the answer so much so that if you were the person running that division, the CEO would later have given you a big bonus for saving the division. But that professor would have given you a 0 because he's not trying to help you save the division. He's trying to teach you the tools and the decision-making process so that when you come to a situation that's 20% different, the tools are still there and you're not going to think, I can get by just on wits and assumptions.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So another way of saying this is the answer to a case study doesn't really exist. So therefore, you can't guess at it. You can't simply read a case study, guys, and say, well, they should do X, because the only thing that matters here in a situation like this is factor alpha or factor bravo. Again, the purpose of the case is not to solve it as much as to prove the student has the tools, analytical abilities, and insights that would allow them to solve other similar problems with different facts and data.
You can't just Google it.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Now, you can go out on the web and learn about a lot of consulting tools. A classic one right now is called MISI, Mutually Exclusive and Collectively Exhaustive, which is a powerful way to analyze and determine things. And we'll talk about that in a future cast. And there are all kinds of other frameworks for thinking about business problems and drilling down into marketing and finance and operations and software and so on. So basically, generally, one's approach, your approach, the application of certain methods, as Dan alluded to, getting a zero if you don't use the methods, even if you get the right answer, is really what's being evaluated. And the reason that's important, guys, is because you won't have all the data available to the original decision makers. You won't, because they can't give you 5 years worth of emails and hundreds of meetings that they went to make the decision that they made. You're going to have to make some assumptions based on the data you're given. And then you're going to have to share your assumptions as you present your solution. In some cases, your necessary assumptions could be wrong, but your answer, and I remember there's not an answer, your process could be deemed to be quite good. And they would say, look, you did it right. You just made a wrong assumption here. That number should be negative and not positive. Oh, okay. Well, that changes the outcome a little bit. But you'll get better over time. The more cases you do, the more likely your assumptions are going to be closer to what's accurate. We're going to talk when it comes to case study interviewing about how part of case studies, one of the really narrow uses of case studies in interviews is math questions. And believe it or not, executives and consultants to executives who are making business-wide decisions are expected to know things like, if sales were 140% above normal and sales were 57 million, you should immediately be able to know what sales were that 57 million is 140% of. And the difference between something being 140% of something and something being 140% above something else. And the reason why that's important is that's the lingo. That's the way executives think and talk to one another. An example that I like is, I mentioned this actually to staff this morning in a call we were on. I said, everybody knows the number 2,000 is if somebody tells you what their hourly pay is, and we assume for a moment they're working 40 hours a week, not that they always are, you just multiply their hourly pay by 2,000, and that will give you a rough estimate of their annual salary. Because people tend to work about 2,000 hours a year, and that's 40 hours a week times 50 weeks. 50 is another number that's fairly well known, that if you get a weekly profit or revenue or cost number, no given week is a perfect microcosm of the entire year, but you can say, if my profit this week was $10,000, our run rate profit for this year is 50 times $10,000, which is $500,000. Our run rate profit is $500,000. And sometimes you say that to people and they go, oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, it's just, you don't do the math to multiply by 52. You just multiply it by 50 to give you a rough estimate. Another thing, sometimes people will say, well, what is that number? And they're not asking you whether it's 16,500 or 17,208. They're asking you whether it's 17, 1700, 17,000, or 17 million. We're talking about orders of magnitude. Because if the difference is only 17, we don't care. If it's 17 million, we do care. We do. Now, another important part of the analysis of a case study response, your response to the study, is the verbalization of your assumptions and the verbalization of your process decisions along the way. And now you can see where communication skills and presentation skills come into it. In some cases, it wouldn't be unusual for a professor or interviewer to contradict one of your key assumptions that you made, yet expect the respondent to continue describing how they approach the problem, knowing full well that their bad assumption is going to lead to failure in the, quote, answer of the case study. And you might still get a very good score from the professor, even though he says, yeah, your assumption was wrong there. And dude, that's disheartening. You know you're wrong. And everybody in the room is like, oh, dude, you're wrong. And yet so you painful. Can get a high score. Yeah, it's absolutely painful. And if you read Snapshots from Hell, I think it's back in the back 10% of the book, maybe page 200 or something like that. It's just, I mean, the guy self-immolates. It's horrible. It's cringeworthy. Exactly.
Cringeworthy. I learned this one the hard way. You know, I had a homina moment, you know, when a professor just torched me in front of the class. And, you know, after that, from that point forward, the people that I worked with and I always had somebody to be the mean person and crush us the night before we presented. And that helped a lot.
Yeah, you want to be able to, I mean, look, you need to stay frosty up there, right? And if you start thinking, I'm screwing this up, when you're in your head saying, I'm screwing this up, you're not solving the problem because your brain can only think of one thing at a time. We say when it comes to interviews and presenting a case to a group of high potentials or people in a business school, things, it's a little bit like an interview. You certainly feel like you're on the spot. And I tell people all the time, you won't ruin an interview because you make a mistake. You'll ruin the interview because the second and third and fourth mistake you make, because in your head, after you make the mistake, the record starts playing in your head. I made a mistake. I made a mistake. I made a mistake. Oh, wait, I just got asked a new question. I'm sorry. What was the question? And now you're on a downward spiral.
I did that.
Yeah. dude, we all have. In future guidance, guys, we're going to talk about some of the tools typically used in case studies, at least at business level. And we're going to do it at somewhat of a high level because there's too many tools and not enough time. And our medium doesn't really allow for the presentation of myriad charts or sales charts or costs or capital outlays. But we can still give you a sense of what you can expect. The primary use of case studies, like we said, is in business schools teaching MBA classes. And again, they span a wide variety of scenarios. Typically, at a school, a case study is given to a class with instructions to work on it for approximately a week in small groups. In the example of high potential programs, I've seen it done two different ways. One, hey guys, we've got this guy coming in to talk about a situation he faced about 5 years ago. Thought we'd share the bones of it with you in an email. Some people don't even read the email. They're like, no, that's a high potential thing. I just go the night before, whatever. You would definitely want to have read that email to have gotten a sense of the case, because if it truly is going to be presented as a case study, the person is not going to tell you what they did. They're going to ask you questions about what you would do, a la the Socratic method. And you want to have known the case in advance. If you get asked, hey, what do you think, Dan? And you say, I'm sorry, I didn't read the case. That's like, I don't think you get to come to the next high potential development meeting, right?
Maybe a lower potential development.
Exactly, the lower.
It involves HR.
Not high pot, but low pot, right?
Okay. Exactly.
So, but at school, it's given to a class and they tell you, hey, you got a week to work on this. And by the way, you're in several different classes, so you may have several different case studies to work on in a given week. So you might be in two to three groups working on three, four, or five cases in a given week. Maybe sometimes less, sometimes more. And by the way, this is in addition to the reading and studying and preparing for class and quizzes and exams and so on that happen. And a case might be 5 to 10 pages long. And there's some story to it. There's charts, there's ideas, there's anecdotes. Some of the anecdotes add color, but not light. Or heat, but not light, if you will, may or may not be relevant. And basically what happens is your small group meets and discusses the case. Usually there's some apportionment of responsibility. Okay, Dan, you take the process piece, build a rough process for us. Cheryl, you take the software development piece because you're an expert there. And Bob, you take the marketing piece or the packaging piece, for instance. And there may be a strategy piece and there may be a few slides about that. And if it's strategy, maybe you're talking about Michael Porter's Five Forces or Blue Ocean or SWOT analysis. If SWOT sounds familiar, guys, yes, we have a podcast about that. Somebody else might be asked to do an analysis of the size of sales force. Do we have too many or too few based on sales per representative versus industry average and benchmarks, which is a huge case study tool, benchmarking, territory sizes, associate tenure. And you'll be given data on all this stuff. Another team member might need to develop a marketing or an advertising plan that's in harmony with the company's values, but stays within a budget that last year's annual report would suggest. You don't get to pick any amount of budget you want because that would be unrealistic. And cases are designed to feel realistic. And as a general rule, once the team has done their individual tasks, they get back together to decide how are they going to present it. Are all three people in the team or four people in the team going to present a little bit? Will the professor allow each person that had each task to present, or will one person be expected to speak for everyone, which is typically the way it is, which enhances teamwork so you don't only have to do one part of it and know only your part. And it could be as simple as, is this really a strategy question, or did the analysis of the company suggest they're going bankrupt and it's only a question of which chapter they're going to be in? Does it need marketing help or sales help? And unfortunately, there are a lot of people who don't know that sales and marketing are two different things. Or should the focus be on high number of defects coming off the production line versus whether or not we're selling? If we're selling a lot, but we're spending a lot of money in returns, which is one of 30 lines buried in a financial chart, you would want to know that before you ramped up production without solving your quality problem. There are other times, guys, where a case revolves around one decision and the group meets together to discuss what solution to recommend and come up with a presentation, again, to support their recommendation. And in the end, the group typically, although there are, again, cases where it's done individually, goes to class with their solution. One group might be called on exclusively, or two to three groups might be asked to present part of theirs and say, okay, group 23, you're done. Now I want group 9 to come up and present the next part. Or nobody presents. Everybody's done some prep on the case, and the professor engages again in that Socratic dialogue with all members of teams, basically the entire class. And even if you weren't the person dealing with market share analysis for your team, you may be called on to talk about your team's work on market share analysis.
That's important to know.
Yeah, dude. So I've always loved it because it's a close approximation to work. You may be the smartest analytical person, but if you can't present, your ideas aren't going to be heard. And in fact, I just wrote a note to myself the other day. One of the podcasts I have to write, and I've never written it, and I don't know why, is what do you do as a manager when one of your people say, well, I'm not a communicator? Well, okay. Well, that's interesting. It's like saying I'm not human, or you know, I'm sorry, I have red hair. Yeah, okay, we don't consider that a disability around here. So typically, when a team is called to present, the presenter or presenters, if they're doing it serially, is routinely interrupted with questions, why they made the assumptions they did, how they decided to choose a certain approach. And the questions are often designed to point out flaws in order to induce stress.
And Mark, for this reason, it's important to think about group selection, if you have a choice, like you think about coworker selection for a special project. This is really important, especially broad cases. Diverse backgrounds are a strength. You have three economists going after a marketing issue, even if they're friends.
Yeah.
It's not going to be friends for long.
And heck, if they're all economists, they're going to all spend the entire time saying, on the other hand. So, what's the great joke about economists? Most people see something in theory and wonder whether or not it'll work in practice. Economists see something working in the real world and then wonder whether or not it works in theory. Yeah, so sometimes the presenter is going to struggle when several mistakes are brought to light. But again, like we mentioned before, they're expected to continue.
Right.
And I alluded to that in the Snapshots from Hell one, which he talks about how he just fell down the various levels of hell. The analysis, the assumptions, the decision, the presentation, the teamwork are all fair game for evaluation of a case study presentation and work. Just like if it were real work in a real company with real consequences. Because even if you've got great financial analysis, if you haven't married it with the strategy to make a recommendation that turns out to be able to work, it doesn't matter how good your financial analysis is. You don't get credit if you're an executive for being really good at only one part of what you're responsible for. That's why we are willing to use the word synthesis. Okay. Dan, do you think we've talked enough about cases in general?
I think we've covered it a lot.
Yeah.
I would just add one thing, right? The stuff is pretty challenging, these cases. But take my example as an IT manager. One day we're talking about caching. And the next day I'm in a meeting and a question is asked of me, should we outsource this? The delineation between manager and executive is not a hard line.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're on thin ice. Having the ability to find, pull, and analyze several cases has been really useful for me, especially when I felt like I was out over my skis.
Yeah. So that ends part one. We hope you'll come back for part two, where we're going to outline the details of the inaugural Manager Tools case study. And I'm thinking that Dan will be much more interactive in this one because he and I collaborated on creating this particular case for everyone. See you next week for the inaugural Manager Tools case study.